Chapter 16. Comey. "It's impossible to make him understand you can't stop these investigations," said Roger Ailes in early May, a frustrated voice in the Trump kitchen cabinet. "In the old days, you could say leave it alone. Now you can say leave it alone, and you're the one who gets investigated. He can't get this through his head." In fact, as various members of the billionaire's cabinet tried to calm down the president during their evening phone calls, they were largely egging him on by expressing deep concern about his DOJ and FBI peril. Many of Trump's wealthy friends saw themselves as having particular DOJ expertise. In their own careers, they had had enough issues with the Justice Department to prompt them to develop DOJ relationships and sources, and now they were always up on DOJ gossip. Flynn was going to throw him in the soup, Manafort was going to roll, and it wasn't just Russia. It was Atlantic City and Mar-a-Lago and Trump Soho. Both Christie and Rudy Giuliani, each a self-styled expert on the DOJ and the FBI, and ever assuring Trump of their inside sources, encouraged him to take the view that the DOJ was resolved against him. It was all part of a holdover Obama plot. Even more urgent was Charlie Kushner's fear, channeled through his son and daughter-in-law, that the Kushner family's dealings were getting wrapped up in the pursuit of Trump. Leaks in January had put the kibosh on the Kushner's deal with the Chinese financial colossus Anbang Insurance Group to refinance the family's large debt in one of its major real estate holdings, 666 Fifth Avenue. At the end of April, the New York Times, supplied with leaks from the DOJ, linked the Kushner business in a front-page article to Benny Steinmetz, an Israeli diamond mining and real estate billionaire with Russian ties who was under chronic investigation around the world. The Kushner position was not helped by the fact that the president had been gleefully telling multiple people that Jared could solve the Middle East problem because the Kushners knew all the best people in Israel. During the first week of May, the Times and the Washington Post covered the Kushner family's efforts to attract Chinese investors with the promise of U.S. visas. The kids, Jared and Ivanka, exhibited an increasingly panicked sense that the FBI and DOJ were moving beyond Russia election interference and into family finances. "Ivanka is terrified," said a satisfied Bannon. Trump turned to suggesting to his billionaire chorus that he fire FBI Director Comey. He had raised this idea many times before, but always seemingly at the same time and in the same context that he brought up the possibility of firing everybody. "Should I fire Bannon? Should I fire Reince? Should I fire McMaster? Should I fire Spicer? Should I fire Tillerson?" This ritual was, everyone understood, more a pretext to a discussion of the power he held than it was strictly about personnel decisions. Still, in Trump's poison-the-well fashion, the should-I-fire-so-and-so question and any consideration of it by any of the billionaires was translated into agreement, as in, "Carl Icahn thinks I should fire Comey, or Bannon, or Priebus, or McMaster, or Tillerson." His daughter and son-in-law, their urgency compounded by Charlie Kushner's rile, encouraged him, arguing that the once possibly charmable Comey was now a dangerous and uncontrollable player whose profit would inevitably be their loss. When Trump got wound up about something, Bannon noted, someone was usually winding him up. The family focus of discussion, insistent, almost frenzied, became wholly about Comey's ambition. He would rise by damaging them. And the drumbeat grew. "That son of a bitch is going to try to fire the head of the FBI," said Ailes. During the first week of May, the president had a ranting meeting with Sessions and his deputy Rod Rosenstein. It was a humiliating meeting for both men, with Trump insisting they couldn't control their own people and pushing them to find a reason to fire Comey. In effect, he blamed them for not having come up with that reason months ago. It was their fault, he implied, that Comey hadn't been fired right off the bat. Also that week, there was a meeting that included the president, Jared and Ivanka, Bannon, Priebus, and White House counsel Don McGahn. It was a closed-door meeting, widely noted because it was unusual for the Oval Office door ever to be closed. "All the Democrats hate Comey," said the president, expressing his certain and self-justifying view. "All the FBI agents hate him, too. 75% of them can't stand him. This was a number that Kushner had somehow alighted on, and Trump had taken it up. Firing Comey will be a huge fundraising advantage, declared the president, a man who almost never talked about fundraising. McGahn tried to explain that, in fact, Comey himself was not running the Russia investigation, that without Comey, the investigation would proceed anyway. McGahn, the lawyer whose job was necessarily to issue cautions, was a frequent target of Trump rages. Typically, these would begin as a kind of exaggeration or acting and then devolve into the real thing, uncontrollable, vein-popping, ugly-faced tantrum stuff. It got primal. Now, the president's denunciations focused in a vicious fury on McGahn and his cautions about Comey. "Comey was a rat," repeated Trump. "There were rats everywhere, and you had to get rid of them. John Dean, he repeated. Do you know what John Dean did to Nixon?" Trump, who saw history through personalities, people he might have liked or disliked, was a John Dean freak. He went bananas when a now gray and much-aged Dean appeared on talk shows to compare the Trump-Russia investigation to Watergate. That would bring the president to instant attention and launch an inevitable talkback monologue to the screen about loyalty and what people would do for media attention. It might also be accompanied by several revisionist theories Trump had about Watergate and how Nixon had been framed. And always there were rats. A rat was someone who would take you down for his own advantage. If you had a rat, you needed to kill it. And there were rats all around. Later, it was Bannon who had to take the president aside and tell him that John Dean had been the White House counsel in the Nixon administration, so maybe it would be a good idea to lighten up on McGahn. As the meeting went on, Bannon, from the doghouse and now in their mutual antipathy to Gervonka, allied with Priebus, seized the opportunity to make an impassioned case opposing any move against Comey, which was also, as much, an effort to make the case against Jared and Ivanka and their allies. The geniuses was one of Trump's terms of derision for anybody who might annoy him or think they were smarter than him. And Bannon now appropriated the term and applied it to Trump's family. Offering forceful and dire warnings, Bannon told the president, "This Russian story is a third-tier story, but you fire Comey, and it'll be the biggest story in the world." By the time the meeting ended, Bannon and Priebus believed they had prevailed. But that weekend, at Bedminster, the president, again listening to the deep dismay of his daughter and son-in-law, built up another head of steam. With Jared and Ivanka, Stephen Miller was also along for the weekend. The weather was bad, and the president missed his golf game, dwelling with Jared on his Comey fury. It was Jared, in the version told by those outside the Gervonka circle, that pushed for action, once more winding up his father-in-law. With the president's assent, Kushner, in this version, gave Miller notes on why the FBI director should be fired and asked him to draft a letter that could set out the basis for immediate dismissal. Miller, less than a deft drafting hand, recruited Hicks to help, another person without clearly relevant abilities. Miller would later be admonished by Bannon for letting himself get tied up and potentially implicated in the Comey mess. The letter, in the panicky draft assembled by Miller and Hicks, either from Kushner's directions or on instructions directly coming from the president, was an off-the-wall mishmash containing the talking points: Comey's handling of the Hillary Clinton investigation, the assertion, from Kushner, that the FBI itself had turned against Comey, and the president's key obsession, the fact that Comey wouldn't publicly acknowledge that the president wasn't under investigation. That would form the Trump family's case for firing Comey. That is, everything but the fact that Comey's FBI was investigating the president. The Kushner side, for its part, bitterly fought back against any characterization of Kushner as the prime mover or mastermind, in effect putting the entire Bedminster letter effort, as well as the determination to get rid of Comey, entirely on the president's head and casting Kushner as passive bystander. The Kushner's side's position was articulated as follows. Did he, Kushner, support the decision? Yes. Was he told this was happening? Yes. Did he encourage it? No. Was he fighting for it, Comey's ouster, for weeks and months? No. Did he fight the ouster? No. Did he say it would go badly? No. Horrified, McGahn quashed sending it. Nevertheless, it was passed to Sessions and Rosenstein, who quickly began drafting their own version of what Kushner and the president obviously wanted. "I knew when he got back he might blow at any moment," said Bannon, after the president returned from his Bedminster weekend. On Monday morning, May 8th, in a meeting in the Oval Office, the president told Priebus and Bannon that he had made his decision. He would fire Director Comey. Both men again made heated pleas against the move, arguing for, at the very least, more discussion. Here was a key technique for managing the president: delay. Rolling something forward likely meant that something else, an equal or greater fiasco, would come along to preempt whatever fiasco was currently at hand. What's more, delay worked advantageously with Trump's attention span. Whatever the issue of the moment, he would shortly be on to something else. When the meeting ended, Priebus and Bannon thought they had bought some breathing room. Later that day, Sally Yates and former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee's Crime and Terrorism Subcommittee and were greeted by a series of furious tweets from the president. Here was, Bannon saw again, the essential Trump problem. He hopelessly personalized everything. He saw the world in commercial and show business terms. Someone else was always trying to one-up you. Someone else was always trying to take the limelight. The battle was between you and someone else who wanted what you had. For Bannon, reducing the political world to face-offs and spats belittled the place in history Trump and his administration had achieved. But it also belied the real powers they were up against. Not people. Institutions. To Trump, he was just up against Sally Yates, who was, he esteemed, such a cunt. Since her firing on January 30th, Yates had remained suspiciously quiet. When journalists approached her, she, or her intermediaries, explained that, per her lawyers, she was shut down on all media. The president believed she was merely lying in wait. In phone calls to friends, he worried about her plan and strategy, and he continued to press his after-dinner sources for what they thought she and Ben Rhodes, Trump's favorite Obama plotter, had up their sleeves. For each of his enemies, and actually for each of his friends, the issue for him came down in many ways to their personal press plan. The media was the battlefield. Trump assumed everybody wanted his or her 15 minutes, and that everybody had a press strategy for when they got them. If you couldn't get press directly for yourself, you became a leaker. There was no happenstance news in Trump's view. All news was manipulated and designed, planned, and planted. All news was, to some extent, fake. He understood that very well because he himself had faked it so many times in his career. This was why he had so naturally cottoned to the fake news label. "I've made stuff up forever, and they always print it," he bragged. The return of Sally Yates, with her appointment before the Senate Judiciary Committee, marked the beginning, Trump believed, of a sustained and well-organized media rollout for her. His press view was confirmed later in May by a lavish, hagiographic profile of Yates in The New Yorker. "How long do you think she was planning this?" he asked rhetorically. "You know she was. It's her payday." "Yates is only famous because of me," the president complained bitterly. "Otherwise, who is she? Nobody." In front of Congress that Monday morning, Yates delivered a cinematic performance. Cool, temperate, detailed, selfless. Compounding Trump's fury and agitation. On the morning of Tuesday, May 9th, with the president still fixated on Comey and with Kushner and his daughter behind him, Priebus again moved to delay. "There's a right way to do this and a wrong way to do this," he told the president. "We don't want him learning about this on television. I'm going to say this one last time, this is not the right way to do this. If you want to do this, the right way is to have him in and have a conversation. This is the decent way and the professional way." Once more, the president seemed to calm down and become more focused on the necessary process. But that was a false flag. In fact, the president, in order to avoid embracing conventional process, or for that matter, any real sense of cause and effect, merely eliminated everybody else from his process. For most of the day, almost no one would know that he had decided to take matters into his own hands. In presidential annals, the firing of FBI Director James Comey may be the most consequential move ever made by a modern president acting entirely on his own. As it happened, the Justice Department, Attorney General Sessions, and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein were, independent of the president's own course, preparing their case against Comey. They would take the Bedminster line and blame Comey for errors of his handling of the Clinton email mess, a problematic charge, because if that was truly the issue, why wasn't Comey dismissed on that basis as soon as the Trump administration took office? But in fact, quite regardless of the Sessions and Rosenstein case, the president had determined to act on his own. Jared and Ivanka were urging the president on, but even they did not know that the axe would shortly fall. Hope Hicks, Trump's steadfast shadow, who otherwise knew everything the president thought, not least because he was helpless not to express it out loud, didn't know. Steve Bannon, however much he worried that the president might blow, didn't know. His chief of staff didn't know, and his press secretary didn't know. The president, on the verge of starting a war with the FBI, the DOJ, and many in Congress, was going rogue. At some point that afternoon, Trump told his daughter and son-in-law about his plan. They immediately became co-conspirators and firmly shut out any competing advice. Eerily, it was a notably on-time and unruffled day in the West Wing. Mark Halperin, the political reporter and campaign chronicler, was waiting in the reception area for Hope Hicks, who fetched him a bit before 5 p.m. Fox's Howard Kurtz was there too, waiting for his appointment with Sean Spicer. And Reince Priebus' assistant had just been out to tell his 5 o'clock appointment it would be only a few more minutes. Just before 5, in fact, the president, having not too long before notified McGahn of his intention, pulled the trigger. Trump's personal security guard, Keith Schiller, delivered the termination letter to Comey's office at the FBI just after 5 o'clock. The letter's second sentence included the words, "You are hereby terminated and removed from office, effective immediately." Shortly thereafter, most of the West Wing staff, courtesy of an erroneous report from Fox News, was for a brief moment under the impression that Comey had resigned. Then, in a series of information synapses throughout the offices of the West Wing, it became clear what had actually happened. "So next it's a special prosecutor," said Priebus, in disbelief, to no one in particular, when he learned shortly before 5 o'clock what was happening. Spicer, who would later be blamed for not figuring out how to positively spin the Comey firing, had only minutes to process it. Not only had the decision been made by the president with almost no consultation except that of his inner family circle, but the response and explanation and even legal justifications were also almost exclusively managed by him and his family. Rosenstein and Sessions' parallel rationale for the firing was shoehorned in at the last minute, at which point, at Kushner's direction, the initial explanation of Comey's firing became that the president had acted solely on their recommendation. Spicer was forced to deliver this unlikely rationale, as was the vice president, but this pretense unraveled almost immediately, not least because most everyone in the West Wing, wanting nothing to do with the decision to fire Comey, was helping to unravel it. The president, along with his family, stood on one side of the White House divide, while the staff, mouths agape, disbelieving and speechless, stood on the other. But the president seemed also to want it known that he, aroused and dangerous, personally took down Comey. Forget Rosenstein and Sessions, it was personal. It was a powerful president, and a vengeful one, in every way galled and affronted by those in pursuit of him, and determined to protect his family, who were in turn determined to have him protect them. "The daughter will take down the father," said Bannon, in a Shakespearean mood. Within the West Wing, there was much replaying of alternative scenarios. If you wanted to get rid of Comey, there were surely politic ways of doing it, which had in fact been suggested to Trump. A curious one, an idea that later would seem ironic, was to get rid of General Kelly at Homeland Security and move Comey into that job. But the point really was that Trump had wanted to confront and humiliate the FBI director. Cruelty was a Trump attribute. The firing had been carried out publicly and in front of his family, catching Comey entirely off guard as he gave a speech in California. Then the president had further personalized the blow with an ad hominem attack on the director, suggesting that the FBI itself was on Trump's side and that it, too, had only contempt for Comey. The next day, as though to further emphasize and delight in both the insult and his personal impunity, the president met with Russian bigwigs in the Oval Office, including Russia's ambassador, Kislyak, the very focus of much of the Trump-Russia investigation. To the Russians, he said, "I just fired the head of the FBI. He was crazy, a real nut job. I faced great pressure because of Russia. That's taken off." Then, to boot, he revealed information supplied to the United States by Israel from its agent in place in Syria about ISIS using laptops to smuggle bombs onto airlines, revealing enough information to compromise the Israeli agent. This incident did not help Trump's reputation in intelligence circles, since in spycraft, human resources are to be protected above all other secrets. "It's Trump," said Bannon. "He thinks he can fire the FBI." Trump believed that firing Comey would make him a hero. Over the next 48 hours, he spun his side to various friends. It was simple. He had stood up to the FBI. He proved that he was willing to take on the state power. The outsider against the insiders. After all, that's why he was elected. At some level, he had a point. One reason presidents don't fire the director of the FBI is that they fear the consequences. It's the Hoover syndrome. Any president can be hostage to what the FBI knows. And a president who treats the FBI with something less than deference does so at his own peril. But this president had stood up to the feds. One man against the unaccountable power that the left had long railed against, and then more recently the right had taken as a holy grail issue too. "Everybody should be rooting for me," the president said to friends, more and more plaintively. Here was another peculiar Trump attribute, an inability to see his actions the way most others saw them, or to fully appreciate how people expected him to behave. The notion of the presidency as an institutional and political concept, with an emphasis on ritual and propriety and semiotic messaging, statesmanship, was quite beyond him. Inside the government, the response to Comey's firing was a kind of bureaucratic revulsion. Bannon had tried to explain to Trump the essential nature of career government officials, people whose comfort zone was in their association with hegemonic organizations and a sense of a higher cause. They were different, very different, from those who sought individual distinction. Whatever else Comey might be, he was first and foremost a bureaucrat. Casting him ignominiously out was yet another Trump insult to the bureaucracy. Rod Rosenstein, the author of the letter that ostensibly provided the justification for firing Comey, now stood in the line of fire. The 52-year-old Rosenstein, who, in rimless glasses, seemed to style himself as a bureaucrat's bureaucrat, was the longest-serving U.S. attorney in the country. He lived within the system, all by the book, his highest goal seeming to be to have people say he did things by the book. He was a straight shooter, and he wanted everyone to know it. All this was undermined by Trump, trashed even. The browbeating and snarling president had hectored the country's two top law enforcement officials into an ill-considered, or at the very least an ill-timed, indictment of the director of the FBI. Rosenstein was already feeling used and abused. And then he was shown to have been tricked, too. He was a dupe. The president had forced Rosenstein and Sessions to construct a legal rationale. Yet then he could not even maintain the bureaucratic pretense of following it. Having enlisted Rosenstein and Sessions in his plot, Trump now exposed their efforts to present a reasonable and above-board case as a sham, and arguably a plan to obstruct justice. The president made it perfectly clear that he hadn't fired the director of the FBI because he did Hillary wrong. He fired Comey because the FBI was too aggressively investigating him and his administration. Hyper-by-the-book Rod Rosenstein, heretofore the quintessential apolitical player, immediately became, in Washington eyes, a hopeless Trump tool. But Rosenstein's revenge was deft, swift, overwhelming, and, of course, by the book. Given the decision of the Attorney General to recuse himself from the Russia investigation, it fell under the authority of the Deputy Attorney General to determine whether a conflict existed, that is, whether the Deputy Attorney General, because of self-interest, might not be able to act objectively, and if, in his sole discretion, he judged a conflict to exist, to appoint an outside special counsel with wide powers and responsibilities to conduct an investigation and potentially a prosecution. On May 17th, 12 days after FBI Director Comey was fired, without consulting the White House or the Attorney General, Rosenstein appointed former FBI Director Robert Mueller to oversee the investigation of Trump's, his campaign's, and his staff's ties to Russia. If Michael Flynn had recently become the most powerful man in Washington for what he might reveal about the president, now Mueller arguably assumed that position because he had the power to make Flynn and all other assorted Trump cronies and flunkies squeal. Rosenstein, of course, perhaps with some satisfaction, understood that he had delivered what could be a mortal blow to the Trump presidency. Bannon, shaking his head in wonder about Trump, commented dryly, "He doesn't necessarily see what's coming."